They now hold farmers and farm families at gunpoint for selling fresh whole milk to friends and neighbors. They now re-engineer the corn we eat so every cell contains a bacterial disease of insects. What was the norm is now a crime. What was a crime against nature is now the norm. This incredible turn of events leads us to ask, what do you think is normal?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 761st edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Ushuaia who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Rick Lachey on the boards. Hello, Rick.
Good day, Michael.
Folks, government special weapons and tactics teams now hold farmers and farm families at gunpoint for selling their fresh whole milk, cheeses, and other farm fresh foods to their friends and neighbors. Those same jackbooted SWAT teams now burst into food cooperatives in the city to destroy all the food and to arrest the members for buying and selling that food to each other. What was normal forever is now a crime. Now they want us to eat without knowing corn that has been genetically re-engineered so that every cell is infused with a bacterial disease of insects. Now they want us to eat foods that have been rendered safe with thousands of chemicals like disodium 5-inosinate, ethyl maltol, and potassium bisulfate. What was a crime against nature is now a norm. This war over what is and what is not normal now leads us to ask, what do you think is normal? We have with us today a man who has an opinion about what is and what is not normal. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the star of stage, screen, and barnyard, author, farmer, and philosopher, Joel Salatin. Joel, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you back. It's been a long time. I think 200, I counted up 269 editions of the Food Chain ago.
Only you would be able to tally those kind of numbers.
Well, it's been a while. And, you know, the last time we worked together, Joel, you brought up this wild and crazy notion that there should be no government standing between a farmer and the consumer of his or her food. But since then, President Barack Obama has appointed Monsanto Executive Michael Taylor to be the nation's food safety czar, and Congress passed a Food Safety Modernization Act that gave Taylor and the FDA the dictatorial control of our food chain. And now government SWAT teams are holding farmers and farm families at gunpoint for doing what was once very normal. And now Joel Salatin comes along with a book that screams out from its cover, folks, this ain't normal. Do you think it will ever become normal for the government to haul farmers like you and Teresa away for selling fresh food to your friends and neighbors?
Well, the fact that they are already doing so much harassment, I mean, from a farmer's market person that wants to wash their mescaline mix and they get denied. You know, they get fined for food processing because washing mescaline mix is a processing food. It can't be done unless you have an inspected kitchen with a license. You know, these kinds of things are becoming more and more common in our culture. I think part of it is just the industrial food system does not like losing market share to upstart integrity food competitors like us. And so, you know, whenever there's a cultural paradigm shift, the entrenched players try to either, if they can't marginalize, then they demonize, and if they can't demonize, then they criminalize.
And so there you are. You know, Joel, I had an attorney come to me here a few months back, and who has no side in this. In this interesting conflict that's going on. And he said, I got this really bizarre letter from one of the big grower associations of the world, one of the associations that represents industrial agriculture. And the letter said something to the effect, If local food is taking a bite out of your profits, join me, join us in Washington, D.C. Your comments?
Wow. Wow. Well, surely, and of course, you're probably well aware of this huge $20 million public relations organization that the industrial food folks have put together. I can't call the name of it right now, but it's a $20 million national advertising effort to correct what they call is the confused consumers.
That would be me.
Yeah, and of course, they say very clearly that these customers have become confused because of the likes of movies like Food Inc. and Fresh and, you know, King Korn and Farmageddon, that consumers are confused. In other words, when consumers were putting their faith in the big corporations and getting TV dinners squirtable, squeezable cheese and unpronounceable food and food you can't make in your kitchen and boxed, microwavable, you know, heat and eat food that won't rot. You can put it on your table for 5 years; it'll just sit there and not rot. I mean, all of this stuff is highly historically abnormal, and people weren't at all confused when they were putting their faith in that. But now that many of us have woken up and say, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, wait a minute," is it possible that there's a relation between type 2 diabetes and, you know, heart problems and cancer and things like that, with all of this food shenanigans going on, and we have launched our counterattack? Now suddenly we have confused the consumer
and are doing a very good job of it. You know, you mentioned a bunch of movies, Joel, and I think you and your Polyface Farm have been featured in all of them, and lots of books too, including Omnivore's Dilemma and whatnot, and have become very famous around the world for being a grass farmer. So I'd like to start today's questioning off with a big question. You know, city people drive down the road, and we see the cows in the feedlots munching their Wheaties, Kellogg's Corn Flakes or whatever. And yet you claim that it's natural for cows to eat grass.
Is it
natural for cows to eat grass?
Absolutely. The cow is an omnivore. And an herbivore, getting ahead of myself.
You got to wait till you get to chickens for that.
That's right, chickens and pigs and us. But cows are herbivores. And, if you think about herbivores around the world, whether it be, Cape Buffalo in Botswana, wildebeest on the Serengeti, yaks in China and Vietnam, and American bison, reindeer, whatever. These herbivores eat, they're essentially a walking fermentation tank, and they take in forage, roughage, grass, blades of things, and they ferment them like sauerkraut in their rumen, and of course, turn them into nutritious milk and meat. So the whole notion of being able to feed grain to these animals has only come as a result of very, very cheap grain, which historically has never occurred. We've only had cheap grain since the onset of petroleum and for cheap transportation fuel and mechanization. Throughout history, grain was way too expensive to have enough left over to feed to herbivores, because you needed it to feed people and a little bit to scatter around for omnivores like chickens and pigs, that sort of thing. Planting grain requires tillage, and when you have to walk all day behind an ox with a sharp stick to till and then hand plant, hand harvest, and flail and winnow and all that, and then store it for a year before the onset of sheet metal and mesh, protective structures to keep rats and mice out of it, that grain was extremely expensive. And, in this book, folks, this ain't normal. I point out that, even the biblical book of Hosea talks about a harlot being sold for 9.5 ephahs of barley. That's about 2.5 bushels of barley. It's not because harlots were cheap. is because barley was very expensive and always has been until extremely recent times.
And thus, somehow, what once was almost totally abnormal, the feeding of grain to cattle and cows, has somehow become normal. And that which was perfectly normal, feeding cattle and cows grass, now has become the abnormal Joel Salatin of Polyface Farms. You know, you've been featured, like I said, in many movies and books and whatnot. But in all of them that I have seen and read, there's one story that hasn't come up that I personally saw when I visited you and Teresa at Polyface Farm there in Swope, Virginia. And I'm going to tell that story when we come back because it really illustrates this whole notion of what it means to be a grass farmer. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. I am Mike Lolshin, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. We're very lucky today because we have Mr. Normal himself, Joel Salatin, all the way from Swope, Virginia, to join us. You can call in, too, 831-479-1080. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, folks, is it normal for cows to eat grass? If you were to drive through California's Central Valley and look at all the feedlots where the cows are all eating Kellogg's cornflakes, you'd think, no, I don't see any cows eating grass. But if you were to hang around Polyface Farms in Swope, Virginia, you would see the cows eating grass. And not only eating grass, but providing for an entire food chain of animals. Joel, is that grass of yours like golf course turf grass? Because, you know, when we city people think of grass, that's what we think about.
Oh, yeah, you're right, Michael. The Americans are brain damaged when it comes to grass. When we say grass, we always think of lawn and lawn or golf courses. But when I say grass, I'm talking about the grass that's like in Little House on the Prairie, Laura Ingalls Wilder, when Ma and Pa wouldn't let the girls go past the threshold of the soddy lest they become lost in the grass. You know, today, if you said that about your house, you'd be looking around for the, you know, for the Landscape Beautification Committee police to be coming and citing you for negligent lawn care. And so this tall grass, I'm talking about the kind that here in Virginia, when Governor Spotswood, before the American Revolution, Governor Spotswood was the British colonial governor in Virginia. He commissioned about a dozen close confidants and dubbed them the Knights of the Golden Horseshoe and sent them on a journey over into the Shenandoah Valley to, you know, scope it out and tell him what they found over there on the other side of the Blue Ridge. And they wrote back and said everywhere they rode up and down the valley, they could take the grass and tie it in a knot above the horse's saddle.
Wow.
That's grass. That's carbon. Go to the University of Lincoln at the University of Nebraska, I'm sorry, at Lincoln, and they've preserved a two-acre native tall grass prairie spot, 2 acres, about the size of 2 football fields. You walk out in there, and this is grass that's 12 feet tall. It's 3/4 inch thick at the base, thick as hair on a dog's back. You walk out there in a path, and I mean, it just completely engulfs you. I can't. When I was out there, it was like a religious experience. It was unbelievable. Still makes me get chill bumps whenever I talk about it. It was that moving for me. And to imagine hundreds and hundreds of miles of that amount of carbon, that amount of biomass, stored solar
Stored energy.
Disposable energy, yeah. Yeah, just waving out there ahead of you had to have been just, it had to have been unbelievable.
Well, you know, what was unbelievable to me was to see your graphs at Polyphase Farms when Saturday morning you took me out to walk the pastures, and what I saw was truly amazing because your grass, though it was light rain was falling, your grass was blue-green and shiny and was standing up in the rain. It was happy grass. And we walked over to look at the fence line, and right on the other side of the fence, the grass was gray and laying down, and it was very sad grass. And so somehow you have made your grass happy. Now, the story doesn't end there because what you do as a grass farmer is you rotate your animals through the pastures.
Right.
And I watched as you were removing a fence, and I watched as your cows all lined up the fence just waiting for you to move that electric fence so they could get into the fresh pasture. And I saw something there that I have never seen in my life, in spite of being around cows and cattle for a good most of that life. I saw your cows run into the new pasture, and they had big, huge, bleep-eating grins on their faces. Now, I've never seen a cow, an elated cow. I've heard of dairies advertising contented cows, but I've never seen elated cows. Was I hallucinating? Are your cows really that happy with that grass?
Oh, listen, they get that what we call a fresh salad bar every single day, or, you know, depending on your special palatability desires, a bowl of ice cream. You know, if every day at 4 o'clock somebody called you to a fresh, you know, buffet, cornucopia of ice cream and salad, you'd have a grin on your face, too.
And they line up and are ready for that.
Yes. Yes. They're very routine-oriented, so we try to move them, you know, within a little bit of 4 o'clock every day, and they get used to that routine, and they're ready to go.
So that leads me to the next question. This routine got you into trouble once because a woman from the city came by and happened to see that your cows were all crowded into a corner of the pasture, and so she reported you to the Humane Society for being cruel to animals. Is it normal for animals to crowd themselves like that?
Well, yeah, we call them herds for a reason. If you look at the wildebeest on the Serengeti, they're a herd. They're not, you know, they're not all staked out on their individual half acre. they crowd up for predator protection, and actually, the crowding up changes their interaction with their hooves and their social interaction with the soil, with the plants. It makes them eat differently. It makes them eat less less carefully, more aggressively, and that gives equal opportunity forage production because they're not being as picky. And
that means you can grow more kinds of forage.
Yes, that means when you mimic these kind of movement mowing and mobbing patterns that we see in herbivorous herds in nature, you get more grass growth, you get more solar conversion into decomposable biomass, and you get a lot more diversity because you are only touching a single square yard, you know, maybe 2 or 3 days a year, and otherwise it's resting and letting all that physiological expression move to its, you know, its full expressive capacity.
Now, is it normal for we city people who have no connection whatsoever with the natural patterns of things anymore, is it normal for us to see what you do and think it makes sense? I wonder because PETA just filed suit in court on behalf of two whales at SeaWorld, because PETA is alleging that SeaWorld is treating these whales as slaves, and that thus violating their 13th Amendment rights. So we city people are becoming awfully strange about how we see animals.
Well, yeah. In fact, in the book, I have a chapter. I think the title is something like, you know, my child is my dog, is my aunt, is my cat. And we have become so Bambi-ited and Disney-fied in our culture to where the only relationship that anybody has with an animal is a pet, that it has given us an incredibly jaundiced view toward the human interaction with the natural world. And for those listening who think that, you know, I must not be able to love anything because I eat animals, let me just encourage you with the notion that in nature, sacrifice precedes life. Decomposition is sacrifice. A compost pile is sacrifice. The way you have life is for something that's living to die and decompose and give its energy and life for something else to happen. When you mash a carrot in your mouth and the carrot gives up its life in your teeth, and you mash that carrot and then you swallow it, and your 3 trillion internal bacteria surround it and devour it, it gives its life for you. And that to me is a powerful metaphor for just a lot of things, including a life of servanthood for us, for each other. You know, that in a marriage relationship, I give life to my spouse by sacrificing, by doing things I don't like, you know, to make her life happy. We give each other life by giving up ourselves for each other. And you know, in farming, and when you're close to this and you see this wonderful life, death, regeneration, cycle in a very visceral way, I think it adds a preciousness and a sacredness to life. But it's a balanced understanding, and
it's something that's hard to understand when you live in the city and there is no connection with life. Folks, Food Chain Radio, Mike Lowson with the man himself, Joel Salatin, and you. Right back, 831-479-1080 if you'd like to join us today. Well, you know, when you talk to a 4-H'er, one of the first things they'll tell you, you know, young kids raising animals for sale at the county fair, one of the first things they'll tell you is that if you name the animal, you can't eat it. Joel, is that the way you find it as well?
Oh, we've eaten things that we've named, but, you know, but we grew up with it. I think that this whole notion that there is some adversarial relationship between humans and plants and humans and animals, I think is a terrible misnomer. Actually, the earth loves to serve us. The earth, and I'm trying to back up here in context. The earth loves to dance with us. I mean, the plants in around our house, the flowers we have, you know, enslaved, confined in a pot. They love to be beautiful for us. The cows love us. We give them a fresh salad bar every day. We treat them. We keep the coyotes away. We have guard dogs for our chickens. This thing that the whales at SeaWorld are not happy. My goodness, they're dancing out there. They love the attention and the performance, just like a dog or a cat or anybody else. And so. I find it sad that so many people think that if I have a relationship with anybody, apparently I have some terrible agenda or some, you know, that I'm going to abuse them, and nothing could be further from the truth.
Well, let me ask you this: what would be normal if PETA gets its way, and somehow takes away the relationship between people and farm animals? Let's say PETA gets its way and you're no longer able to raise farm animals. What happens to farm animals then? What would be their normal? Would there be cows?
Well, there wouldn't be. there would not be, let's cut to the chase, there would not be a functional ecology. There is no environment. There is no ecology in the world that doesn't have animals. In fact, you know, we have 3 trillion animals inside of us, 3 trillion bacteria. And as soon as somebody says, oh, but you know, those aren't important because they're not sentient beings. Whoa, wait a minute. What is it that makes you think that because a life form, something living that looks more like us, why is it more important than a life form that doesn't look like us? And so the folks that are, you know, chowing down on tofu, thinking they're not killing anything, they're eating the soybeans, which are babies. They're embryo, they're babies. And so you're eating a bunch of babies. You say, well, it doesn't look like people. Well, what kind of an egocentric view is that, that you think that life that looks like you is far more important than life that doesn't look like you? I mean, these are incredibly strange things. And I would suggest, you know, if we could laugh about it a little bit, I would suggest that the fact that we can even have this discussion is extremely historically aberrant.
Well, and yet it has become the normal. You know, it has historically totally abnormal. But in contemporary times, it is normal. I mean, my goodness, they're throwing farmers who sell milk up against the wall and sticking an automatic weapon in their face and saying, you can't do that. And that's how we live forever. And yet now it's abnormal. It's not only abnormal, it's a crime. What on earth is happening? And that's the question we're trying to come to grips with today here on The Food Chain with your host, Michael Olson, and Joel Salatin, author of Folks, It Ain't Normal. Do you ever feel like screaming that when you're in an airport and seeing all of the things that happen there?
Oh. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's how I came up with the title, was just, you know, I do a lot of speaking and traveling and just seeing. I mean, I was in a room one day, and there were about 20 young people in this room that was no larger than our living room. They were actually in a work orientation thing. 20 young people in there. Literally sitting on sofas, that they were ready for a work site orientation thing, and every single one of them was on their BlackBerry or their iPhone, and there was not one single. The room was totally quiet except for the click, click, click of stuff, and they weren't even working. You know, they weren't even. It was just a work orientation meeting, and so yeah, you just want to go in and shake them and say, look at me.
Well, this is really interesting because it leads into my next one of my questions that I really wanted to ask you. And you talk a lot about the relationship, your family, and the kids that come to work with you as interns and whatnot. The relationship you have with work. Is it normal for us to like work and for kids and children to like work?
Yes. It is totally normal to, and it's aberrant to think of work as demeaning. This spans a lot of facets right now. I mean, just work in itself is considered something that I do in order to earn enough money so that I can really live, rather than the work being a passionate vocation that grows out of my soul's desire and my own personal gifts and talents. And it's been even translated to the point that in our culture, anybody who actually works in the soil or has calluses and splinters and does blue collar type, you know, we even call it blue collar, white collar, as a kind of a demeaning way. And parents are sending children with tremendous craft abilities and fabrication abilities and innovative manufacturing capacities, tearing them up in college, trying to turn them into, you know, some sort of a cerebral person who has no visceral relation with their, you know, with their gifts and talents. And I think that's a terrible thing. And actually, we see them. You know, we see them here. We get requests for internships from 40 and 50 year old people that are absolutely burned out in their Dilbert cubicle, and they've always wanted to do something physical, something that they could look at the end of the day and say, "There it is. I can touch it. I can smell it. I can see it."
And any so of and any of those of us who have worked on a farm know exactly that's what you get. You wake up and you're hungry, and you eat, and you go out and you work, and you find something that needs fixing, and you work on it, and you fix it. You had this wonderful description in Folks This Ain't Normal about working a snag of trees in your woodlands. Would you talk about that? Would you talk about the joy you get out of working a snag of trees?
Yes. There are a few things that are as emotionally enjoyable to me as working in a woodlot. You go in there, and it's chaotic. You know, it's disorganized. There are dead trees, diseased trees, fallen over trees, and there are some beautiful trees screaming for release, screaming to let me reach for the sky and all that. And so you go in there, and you clean out the brush. You take out the diseased and the crooked ones. And you release those nice ones, and you get the firewood in, you stack the brush for some rabbits and squirrels and chipmunks and things to come and live in this little brush pile as it slowly decomposes. And when as we leave, sitting atop that load of wood, we're looking back into that little whatever quarter acre or whatever spot we were able to work in. There's this huge satisfaction of order out of chaos. And I'm not saying, manipulation and egocentricity. I'm saying that from an ecological standpoint, we have restored an order, and we have created a habitat in a way.
And we have to take a quick break, but that was beautiful. Right back with Teresa on the line, and you do stay tuned. Hey, welcome back. Michael Olson here. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're talking with Mr. Farmer himself, Joel Salatin. Well, he is a farmer of certain kind of farmer. He's a grass farmer, which is to say he farms grass, he grows the grass, and then he mows all kinds of animals through that grass. How many animals do you have at Polyface Farm, Joel?
You mean types of species?
No. How many animals do you have there?
Oh, my goodness. We've got several thousand chickens. We've got 500 pigs, a couple hundred cows, a couple hundred rabbits. We don't have our meat chickens or turkeys yet because the season doesn't start. We won't get our first ones until March 1st, mm-hmm. early March, I guess. But there's a lot of critters here,
and you have them all working in concert.
Yes, rather than being segregated, they're actually symbiotic. They're actually relationships. We move the chickens behind the cows with an egg mobile and mimicking the bird. You know, the egret on the rhinos knows the birds that follow the herbivores in nature. We use pigs to do our composting. So in the winter, when we're feeding hay, we use a wood chips and sawdust and old hay as a carbonaceous diaper to soak up the cattle droppings and put corn in it. The cows tramp out the oxygen; it all ferments. Then the pigs go in after the cows come out. The pigs go in and fluff it all up with their noses, and which they love to do. That's hog heaven. It allows the pig to fully express their pigness. And in doing so, they make our aerobic compost, which then completes the cycle of solar energy into biomass and the decomposition into soil fertility, which then grows the next grows the next crop of grass. So it's all one big cycle.
You know, when I visited you, there was a line of people standing there waiting. You were in the shed butchering chickens, and there was a line of people waiting to buy those chickens. And I asked the lady in line, where'd you come from? She said, well, Washington, D.C. And I said, so you drove, 3 hours to buy a chicken? And she said, no. I drove 3 hours to buy a Salatin chicken.
That must make you feel pretty darn good.
Let's go to the phones. I'd like to share you with some people. Folks, the phone numbers today, if you'd like to talk with Joel Salatin, 831-479-1080. Teresa, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. Joel, I am a big fan of yours. From the book Everything I Want to Do is Illegal to a recent video on being a sissy farmer. And I want to speak to this idea that meat animals and pets are not mutually exclusive. I have a radio show called Third Paradigm with an episode called Love 'em and Eat 'em, The Art of Animal Husbandry. And the point that I make is that if we can't eat the animals that we love, that we're condemning the animals that are eaten to being lonely, unloved, and isolated. And so what we do is we graze meat bunnies for a couple of proteges of yours, Kevin and Shaylin Watts at Early Bird Ranch.
Yeah.
And so we have them in our front yard, and all the kids from the high school and the middle school walk past, and they admire the little cute bunnies, and they say, well, how do you do this? How do you always have these adorable baby bunnies? And we just graze them in our yard until they're big enough, and then we trade them back to Kevin and Shaylin, and we get new baby bunnies. It's a beautiful relationship. And they get to come to Disneyland, which is what they call it here.
Right. And so if you, the point is that if there was no market for eating rabbit, then there wouldn't be a continual pipeline of new bunnies for you to enjoy.
Absolutely.
What a great point. Thank you.
And you know what Teresa said also really struck me about eating the animals you love. And I think about, Joel, your animals. And when I listened to that gal from Washington, D.C., who, you know, had driven 3 hours to buy a chicken, and I got to thinking, now how in the hell can I stuff some chickens in my suitcase and fly them back to California? Because I want to eat those kinds of animals, too. I want to eat happy. I want to eat animals that are elated with being alive. I don't want to eat animals that are stuck in a feedlot eating Kellogg's cornflakes and looking so sad. Teresa?
I think that's a great concept, that being able to have these animals as pets in a place that's urban, and then being able to, you know, eat them and enjoy them and know that that what you're eating is something that you can eat with a good conscience because it has had a wonderful, wonderful life. It just is, it's good all around.
Hey, Joel, Teresa raises another interesting notion in my thoughts, and that is it normal to eat local food?
Well, yeah, that used to be about the only kind of food that you could have. In you know, as late as the mid-1940s, the average food miles in America was still less than 100 miles. Before the 1940s, it was only 40 miles, the average food miles in America. Now, today, it's 1,500 miles. And, of course, we have, you know, a lot of energy consumption in to make that chain occur. So, eating locally was historically the normal position, and even having a domestic larder. We don't even have domestic larders anymore where, you know, everybody has to go to the supermarket.
Can you hold that thought? Because I really do want to talk about how normal it is for a city to only have 3 days' worth of food in its larder. Folks, this is The Food. Can you stick with us, Teresa?
Sure.
This is The Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Joel Salatin, the man from Swope, Virginia, and you, 831-479-1080, if you care to join us. We're talking food and you. Well, so much to talk about and so little time to talk about it in. We're talking with Joel Salatin, author of Folks, This Ain't Normal. And it doesn't seem to me like it's getting any more normal. And I guess the real question is, what is normal to you? Is it normal to eat what they want you to eat? Is it normal for us to throw farmers up against the wall and you know, with SWAT teams and arrest them for selling fresh whole milk to eat to family and friends? Is that kind of stuff normal now? Are you going to accept that for being normal? It appears that that's where the government is headed with us. Or maybe it just seems that way to me. Joel Salatin, you know, we've got a few minutes left. Can the Salatin way become the normal way? Is there enough resources in America to feed us as you are feeding us?
Oh, not only is there enough in the big picture, it's the only way that actually will feed us. Normally, people had their food embedded near them. you know, America now has 36 million acres of lawn. 35 million acres of lawn. I missed the million. And then we have 36 million acres devoted to the recreational feeding and housing of recreational horses. That's 71 million acres. And according to John Jevons, the biointensive gardening guru, that's enough to feed the entire country without a single farm. So the fact is that a normal food system is one that is very closely integrated and embedded with where we live. So we're talking about edible landscapes. We're talking about eating seasonally. We're talking about refining or relearning domestic culinary arts so that we preserve, prepare, can, and package our food in-house from seasonal bounty and enjoy it unseasonally, whether it's, you know, frozen, dried, canned, whatever. This is historical normalcy. The food was always kept near where we lived, and today we have this kind of food apartheid, if you will, where we don't intersect with it except in some nameless, faceless box with a SKU number on it that we pop in the microwave, and that's the only interaction we have, and so it creates an emotional sense of precariousness. When we're not nestled in this wonderful ecological womb of Earth's bounty.
Are there enough children ready to take up this mantle?
Well, that's a good question. I am really tickled to death that we're having such an interest among young people to do this, and I think that when the average person is ready to purchase really honest food, I think the young people will be there to do it. I think it'll be more expensive food at the cash register. It'll be cheaper in the long run because it'll be better for the environment, for our health, and for our economy.
Michael Olson's third law of the food chain: cheap food ain't.
That's correct. That's correct. So it'll be honest priced, and that'll be okay, and that'll provide a living for a lot of people. You know, you really don't need soda, tobacco, liquor, you know, Starbucks coffee. I mean, as much as wonderful as all those things are, you really don't need fast food, McDonald's. You don't need $100 designer jeans. You don't need
We need is real life, and yeah. Joel Salatin's got it in spades at Polyface Farm in Swope, Virginia. Joel, thank you so much for joining us. I wish we had about 53 hours to just sit and talk and talk and talk and talk. Phones are going off like crazy, and we're out of time. Joel Salatin, author of Folks, This Ain't Normal. Pick it up, enjoy it, have a great time. See you next week for more What's Eating What Radio on the Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.